and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotin in Washington, D.C.
If judicial light is deemed on it, that his credentials will not stand. And as a result of that, he will be deemed not fit to contest the presidential election in 2023. What we are saying is that the court should disqualify him as a result of fake credentials. That is what we want. That is our prayer.
Lawyers from a Nigerian opposition party plan to petition a court to challenge the academic credentials of Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu, presidential candidate of the ruling All Progressives Congress.
You stay at our in the university, study the theory that you have to remember, but then the practicals or the how to do, you go to this organization. But the teacher as well is a learner in this process.
The Vice Chancellor of Victoria University in Uganda calls for a fundamental change in teaching and learning in schools across the country and the rest of Africa.
We see cases, typically cases that are victims of torture, cases that have been trafficked. There are substantial medical needs that must be meeting that as well. And what we are highlighting is the need and the capacity for that support to be provided in safe third countries, such as in Europe and such as in North America.
And Doctors Without Borders call on safe countries in North America and Europe to help protect migrants in Libya. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, lawyers from the opposition Action People's Party plan to petition a court on Monday. They will challenge the academic credentials of Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu, presidential candidate of the ruling All Progressives Congress. The opposition party contends that academic qualifications Tinubu presented to the Independent Electoral Commission failed to meet electoral requirements. The allegations follow local media reports regarding material Tinubu submitted to the electoral body. The opposition party argues the documents differ from those Tinubu presented while seeking to become the governor of Lagos State. Supporters of the ruling party say the planned court petition is a publicity stunt to tarnish Tinubu's image, make him unpopular, and to make the opposition party relevant ahead of next February's general election. For more about the planned court petition, I read Uche Nandi. He is the national chairman of Nigeria's opposition Action People's Party.
Yes, why we decided as a party to take him to court on some of the allegation of falsification of results and credentials is because the law permits that, the Electoral Act permits that. It grants every person, association, that feels that the candidates publish that their credentials or their details are not clear can approach the court. So it's a legal right granted unto us. That's why we want to explore it.
But some people suggest that he who alleges must prove. Do you have empirical proof or evidence that he doesn't have the qualifications that he says he has?
As a party, we have looked at it extensively, and the legal department of the party recommends that there is an action to be sustained against him. And that is why we are approaching the court. It is the court that will determine whether allegation is right or wrong.
But some people are also asking, why now? Because he has been a Lagos State governor two terms. He served Nigeria well. And he has won a legitimate primary of the ruling APC. What does that concern the Action People's Party, they suggest? What's your response to that?
Now, there is no other better time than now. Like you said earlier on, he was a Lagos State governor in 1999 and 2003. He exited in 2007. And since then, he has not contested any elected position. This is first political outing since he left office as Lagos State governor. So what we are saying is that some of the details he furnished when he was contesting an election in 1999, and the present one, they don't tally. We looked at it, and we believe that some of the credentials he submitted need to be investigated. That is why we are approaching the court. There is no other better time than now to do it.
But what about those who are saying that your party appears to be doing the work of his detractors or his opponents just to undermine him, to make him unpopular ahead of next year's general election?
It is someone who is politically ignorant that can have this view, because we are one of the registered 18 political parties in Nigeria. We have a presidential candidate also we are projecting. The essence of the existence of every political party to capture power, how can we be doing it for the gain of any other of the of the 18 registered political parties? We are doing it because we know we own that duty to Nigerians. And we also know that it will entrench democracy and as well give our candidates a better opportunity to emerge.
So basically, this is just peer politics, because some people are saying it's not only peer politics, but also a publicity stunt just to make your party relevant ahead of the elections, because they call your party a minor political party with no realistic chance of winning the presidential election next year.
Like I just told you earlier on, that it is out of sheer ignorance that anyone can hold that view. Any person who is not satisfied with the details of any candidate can approach the court. And as a political party, we have considered this fact, and we are saying there is need for judicial satellite to be beamed on the credentials submitted by Aswaji Tinubu, the presidential candidate of a progressive party, because we believe that if judicial light is beamed on it, that his credentials will not stand. And as a result of that, he will be deemed not fit to contest the presidential election in 2023. What we are saying is that the court should disqualify him as a result of fake credentials. That is what we want. That is our prayer.
Uche Nnamdi is the national chairman of Nigeria's opposition Action People's Party. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. In Uganda, the Vice Chancellor of Victoria University is calling for a fundamental change in teaching and learning in schools across the East African country and the rest of Africa. Dr. Lawrence Koreta Muganga is also the author of You Can't Make Fish Climb Trees. He says teachers and industries must be deeply involved in the education of students to ensure they are fully prepared for the real world when they graduate. This, he says, will empower the students to solve problems faced by society. And by doing so, Muganga says, the graduates can create jobs for themselves, employ others, and sharply reduce the high unemployment rate. Students and teachers at Victoria University, Muganga says, have fully embraced the new way of teaching, and the country, he adds, will benefit. For more on the call for a fundamental change in teaching and learning in Ugandan schools, I reach Dr. Lawrence Koreta Muganga.
Education as it is today, we need to have it changed fundamentally, looking at the nature of teaching, learning, and then bring in that aspect that matches the people in their real life setting. So in other words, education has to mirror real life. Schools or universities of simply remembering have no place in today's world, certainly not in Uganda. Rather, we have to have schools of practice, which we think would produce expertise, increasing our people's ability to acquire knowledge, skills, and experience is more important than them remembering facts that 98% of those they will never use in their real life. We had to chart a new path, a new pathway that we think can actually speed up the country's development if it is massively implemented. So, and this is as simple as thinking or going back to what we know all in Africa, which is indigenous African education, where people learn by doing.
How are the students responding to this new way of teaching? Because before they got to you, it's all about memorizing and practicing. It's about the old way of schooling. With this new paradigm shift, how are they reacting to it?
You have actually hit the nail on the head. I can tell you that students are very, very much excited, responding to it positively. You know why? Because it is putting them at the center of their learning, because they are in the driver's seat of their learning. Because we know that at the end of the day, these students have to solve a particular problem. Society is full of so many problems. And if one student can solve a problem, it means they are not going to look for a job. They have to monetize this solution, and then they have a job for themselves and have jobs for others.
How long do you think Ugandans will see this bearing fruits?
We are seeing this in the next, for example, next 5 years, it having taken shape. Most of colleges, universities, and even lower levels of education, for example, like primary and secondary or high school, embracing this model. And once everyone is taking up this model, we would be in the right direction.
Talking about changing the status quo, that means that teachers would also have to be really equipped with a hands-on approach. The way teachers are trained has to be different now, and their thinking has to be different now. How are you engaging teachers to go in this direction as well?
I want to use my university, where I am the vice chancellor of the university. So what we have done, and which our goal is to scale it up to even as many institutions as possible. So we believe that for us, we cannot teach any student experience, but the industry can. And yet the consumer of our product, who is the student, is the industry. So now the teaching and learning has to be conducted by both the university or the teacher and the industry or the labor market. So now, in other words, we have to be co-educators. Now, when we talk about the teachers themselves, you're right. They have to be brought up to speed when it comes to technology, to also understand, have these competences. In other words, they have to also learn by doing. That's why we have some of our implementation approaches, we embraced or we have adopted partnering with as many organizations as possible. In other words, every student is attached to a particular organization. So you stay at our in the university, study the theory that you have to remember, but then the practicals or the how to do, you go to this organization. But the teacher as well is a learner in this process.
Dr. Lawrence Koreta Muganga is the Vice Chancellor of Victoria University. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Without Borders is calling on safe countries, including those in North America and Europe, to help protect migrants who are trapped in Libya. The group also called for the speedy evacuation of vulnerable people. This, the medical group says, can be done by opening several routes for trapped migrants to leave the country and by strengthening existing mechanisms for evacuation. Representatives of Doctors Without Borders say since the group started its humanitarian response to Libya in 2016, it has struggled to protect migrants, including those in detention centers. For more about the latest development, I reached Steve Perbrick. He is Libya Migration Advocacy at Doctors Without Borders.
So
The reason MSF is calling for the evacuation of migrants and refugees from Libya is because in 2016 we started working on projects in Libya focusing on the health needs for migrants, particularly in detention and migrants forcibly returned by the Libyan Coast Guard. We're pushing now for urgent evacuations because we've been referring cases for some time for resettlement and evacuation, but the process is very slow and extremely limited, and the needs haven't changed fundamentally in Libya. There are still migrants who are victims of torture, victims of trafficking, who have been victims of slavery as well, who still live in an extremely precarious situation in Libya without any legal protection, and who, in order to protect them, need to be evacuated.
So what specific countries are we referring to here? And what has been the response from those countries that MSF is calling on them to help?
We're engaging with a number of different states about the possibility of evacuating or resettling increased numbers from Libya, focusing in particular on Europe and North America, but not exclusively. The reaction varies country to country, and it varies depending on each country's asylum system as well. Our point more broadly, though, is that the existing systems that are in place fundamentally do not function, are not fit for purpose compared to the needs that we see inside Libya. What we see is MSF with our patients, our urgent medical needs and urgent protection needs, which aren't met with slow processes and limited spaces for evacuations and resettlements. I wouldn't say that we don't have a receptive ear from a number of potential countries for reception, but the processes have been extremely slow until now. And it's one of the reasons we are pushing with this advocacy is because we haven't seen satisfactory progress over the years.
What are the prospects of this advocacy to have these countries act? Because some say due to the prevailing economic challenges around the world, these countries are too preoccupied with their own citizens. So that is not their priority. That thinking about protection for migrants might not be in the picture for now. What's your response to that?
It's a good question. I think what we've seen is, in fact, and particularly in response to the Ukraine war, is we've seen people who are willing to open their homes and to host migrants and refugees. There are a number of examples in Europe where individual cities or villages have expressed their desire to receive refugees, yet only to be told that there's no system in place in their country for those cases to be processed. I think there's a very strong willingness at community level for this, and it's a question of overall political will which needs to be addressed. But we have seen some really positive examples as well. In our report, we do outline the collaboration with some Italian civil society actors, for example, to welcome and to support the arrival in Italy of evacuated migrants and refugees from Libya. So from our perspective, I think there is a willingness and there is an interest, particularly at the community level, to support and to provide protection for people who are trapped in Libya.
What does the MSF want these countries specifically to do in order to ensure the protection of migrants trapped in Libya?
We are asking that countries open the possibility of evacuation corridors from Libya to accept vulnerable migrants and refugees as quickly as possible. So there is always a question of administration, visas, security clearance, etc. These can be expedited, and we have seen examples where they can be sped up, and we are asking these faster processes are put in place to ensure that people are not left waiting in Libya for 12 months or longer in order to be evacuated. We are also asking countries to increase their slots for evacuations or resettlements. Again, each country has a different asylum and refugee regime, but one thing that is possible is to increase the numbers, and that's the other gap this year. There are very few slots for resettlements and evacuations for people inside Libya, the vulnerable migrants and refugees, and these must be increased, and that is our second key ask. Finally, I will add that because of the nature of the cases we see with our patients, and we see some extreme cases, we see cases, typically cases that are victims of torture, cases that have been trafficked, there are substantial medical needs that must be meeting that as well. And what we are highlighting is the need and the capacity for that support to be provided in safe third countries, such as in Europe and such as in North America.
Steve Pobrick is Libya Migration Advocacy at Doctors Without Borders. He spoke with me from Paris, France.
Activists in Botswana have slammed the Kimberley process, which is intended to prevent diamonds from financing wars, after meetings this week failed to censure Russia. The European Union and allies sought to expand the definition of conflict diamonds to include top supplier Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. For viewing, Kodisi Dube reports from the Botswana capital, Gaborone.
A push to get Russian diamonds censored during a week-long meeting in the resort town of Kasane came up empty. The EU, Ukraine and the United States had wanted the Kimberley Process intersessional meeting to broaden the definition of conflict diamonds in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February. Russia is the world's largest producer of diamonds. Speaking at the closing meeting Friday, Kimberley Process Chairperson Jacob Tamahe said the efforts of the EU and its allies failed to go through due to lack of consensus.
You will recall that when we started on Monday afternoon, it took quite an inordinate amount of time to reach consensus on the agenda, as initially we had the EU proposing inclusion of an agenda item around which there was no consensus. Ideas and proposals were tabled for inclusions on the agenda. For instance, those who supported the EU's initial proposal wished a modified proposal that spoke to preventing diamonds from fueling conflicts.
World Diamond Council Chairperson Edward Asher says there is need for reforms, particularly with the definition of conflict diamonds.
This year, throughout our engagements with many government participants here in Kasane, there seems to be strong support for further reforms, including that of the conflict diamond definition. We joined a session hosted by the Civil Society Coalition and were pleased to be able to conduct an open and honest dialogue about the reform of the KP. We would like to see these discussions continued within the KP.
Asher says he still has confidence and belief in the Kimberley process. Despite recent criticism, the Diamond Trade Body is losing relevance. However, Hans Mickert, a member of the Kimberley Process Civil Society Coalition, was disappointed with the outcome of the Botswana meeting.
The consensus system in the Kimberley process makes it too easy for just a small minority to hold everyone hostage. And the consensus model is really being abused to veto discussions and to veto any progress. And the problem, of course, is that in this world that is bypassing the Kimberley process.
Mickert adds it is disappointing that discussions on Russia's invasion of Ukraine were blocked.
We had somewhat expected that a discussion on whether Russian diamonds must be seen as conflict diamonds now with the invasion of Ukraine, that discussion would be blocked. We were prepared that veto power would be used to avoid the KP to address that. But what was worse is that we even couldn't have a discussion on what the KP's general weaknesses are in how the KP generally falls short in breaking the link between diamonds and violent conflicts.
The world's leading diamond producers, drawn from 85 countries, will return to Botswana in November for plenary discussions. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
Straight Talk Africa, we'll look at the U.S. investigation into the January 6, 2021 insurrection that has shaken the country. Many Americans believe their democracy is being threatened. Also, will electricity blackouts worsen in Africa? And how will countries on the continent meet their energy needs? Join me, Heidi Adams, and my guests for an in-depth look at these issues on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. But first, the Republic of the Congo is organizing elections to local offices and the National Assembly, which will be held on July 10. The ruling party is confident it will prevail. But one section of the opposition has decided to boycott the polls, while another believes that's a bad idea. For VOA, Rosie Pioth has this report from Congo Republic's capital, Brazzaville.
Mathias Nzon is the president of the Alliance for Renewal and Democracy and one of the main opposition leaders in the Republic of Congo. After taking part in the presidential election in March 2021, he boycotted the legislative polls. He believed that the government had not played fair and called for talks.
La loi électorale est mauvaise.
He says that the commission electoral law is bad, and the electoral commission is actually a board of ruling party supporters.
Donc, ce sont des mauvaises élections. Si nous voulons avoir de bonnes élections, des bons députés,
he says that alors il faut to have good elected deputies, the foundation of electoral system needs to be rebuilt, and that must come from an inclusive and national dialogue. Roque Regis Bikwa is a candidate of the Movement for Unity, Solidarity and Work in Brazzaville. He says that there is no reason for a boycott of the legislative elections. This, given the crisis of legitimacy now stressed by the country's opposition parties.
L'heure n'est plus à laisser le temps.
He says that the time has come to stop leaving the field open to the ruling Congolese Party of Labour or PCT, to do what it wants, because the country belongs not just to the party in power, but to everyone. He says that the ruling party or government has planned an intelligence agent within the opposition to weaken it. He says change will come when the opposition asks people to take to the streets. According to authorities, the people are sovereign, and time after time, the ruling party has enjoyed the support of a majority of voters. Antoine Aimé Obamondon, candidate of the Congolese Party of Labour, believes that with the call for a boycott, the opposition is running away before a fight.
Ils ont sûrement évalué les rapports de force. Nos frères
he says that the part of the opposition that's boycotting the polls has assessed the balance of power on the ground and believe that they have no chance of winning.
La marche vers
so
le développement,
their decision is a wise
pour la
one.
Sagesse.
More than 570 candidates will compete for the 151 seats in the lower house of parliament. The defense and security forces will go to the poll on July 4th. The rest of the country will vote on July 10th. A low participation remains a concern for many parties. For VOA News, I'm Rosie Piot in Brazzaville.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. We begin with tennis. The third Grand Slam of the year gets underway on Monday. One of Africa's biggest female tennis players at the moment, Tunisian Ons Jabeur, currently ranked number 3 in the world, will play Mirjam Björklund, who is ranked 123 in the world, in the first round of the tournament at the All England Club on Monday. Jabeur comes into Wimbledon as one of the in-form players and favourites for the title, having won her second title of the season in Berlin. Previously, Jabeur's best result was reaching the quarterfinals at Wimbledon in 2021, but she's determined to win her first Grand Slam title in England.
Wimbledon has always like a special place in my heart. Before it was the French Open, since it was always close to Tunisia. I grew up playing on clay a lot, but you know, grass, I usually play football, not tennis. But it's, I mean, it's amazing. And what I experienced last year, the emotions on center court and everything that happened, I think just it became a dream, you know, and I wish I can have that dream one day.
Two goals by striker Abubakar Abdullahi helped the Golden Eagles of Nigeria to defeat the Baby Stallions of Burkina Faso 2-1 to win the WAFU Under-17 Championship at Cape Coast Stadium in Ghana on Friday night. The two finalists in Friday's match have already secured tickets to play at the 2023 Under-17 African Cup of Nations in Algeria next year. The tournament will serve as a qualifier for the FIFA Under-17 World Cup, as the top four sides in the competition will represent Africa at the global tournament scheduled for Peru. The victory for Nigeria comes a few weeks after the country's under-20 team won the WAFU Under-20 title in the tournament played in Niger. Elsewhere in North Africa, Egyptian top club side Ismaili have withdrawn from the 2021-2022 Egypt Cup round of 16, saying the draw of the tournament that was held on Saturday night was not fair. The Dervishes have been drawn to face Egyptian Premier League title holders Zamalek, who were put on the group's lead without draw alongside Al Hakli, who also led the other group without joining the draw. The club, in a statement, said the draw was held for the benefit of specified teams after the competition's committee and Egyptian Premier League board decided to separate Al Hakli and Zamalek on the top of the two groups without joining the draw. The draw of the round of 16 of the 2021-2022 season of Egypt's secondary club competition was held on Saturday at the headquarters of the Egyptian Football Association. Staying with football news, Nottingham Forest has signed Nigerian forward Taiwo Awoniyi from Union Berlin for a club record fee in the region of £17.5 million. The 24-year-old Nigerian joins Forest from the Bundesliga club in a five-year deal and becomes the newly promoted Premier League side's first international signing of the summer. Awoniyi scored 20 goals in 43 games across all competitions last season and becomes Forest's first signing since gaining promotion back to the Premier League. He told Forest TV that it has always been his dream to play in the English Premier League.
For me, it's always about hard work, dedication, and of course, believing in God. And when I look at the games we played in Union Berlin, the season we had, it's all about the team for me. And looking at Forest, when I look at the history, I think it's more of the team also. And this is the kind of place I love to belong to. Every strike I want to score goals, of course, which is the most important thing.
Incumbent president of the South Africa Football Association, Danny Jordan, has been elected to serve a third term. His main challenger in the election, Ria Ledwaba, had lost her court bid to prevent the South African Football Association Elective Congress from going ahead. She had gone to a high court in Pretoria with an application to interdict the Elective Congress, alleging various procedural irregularities. In his acceptance speech, Danny Jordan promised to improve the fortunes of the national teams.
There are structural issues that affect national teams that we have to address. And in that workshop or in Durban that we're going to call, these issues will be addressed. Inside SAFA, we must strengthen the technical capacity in SAFA.
In swimming news, South Africa Lara Van Niekerk bagged a bronze medal in the 50th breaststroke in the World Aquatics Championships on Saturday night. Competing in her first major event at senior level, the 19-year-old came up against world record holder Benedicta Piliato and 2013 world champion Ruta Miliutie in the final. Van Niekerk swam 29.90 seconds to take the bronze, with Miliutie taking gold for Lithuania in 29.70 seconds and Piliato the silver for Italy in 29.80 seconds. And that's it for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, there were three summit meetings in three continents that may be relevant to the African continent. With respect to the EU summit in Europe, in Brussels, the focus remains Russia's war in Ukraine and the impact it is making on the European continent, particularly the want to continue their efforts to counter what they regard as Russia's aggression in Ukraine. In this connection, President Zelensky of Ukraine finally was able to address delegates of the African Union. He continued the campaign of the Western countries to convince Africa and others in the Global South to condemn Russia for its action in Ukraine. President Zelensky warned African states that they were being manipulated by Russia and that they should give support to Ukraine. He went on to state categorically that the food crisis that is appearing a menace to the African continent was solely due to Russia's blockade in the Black Sea, which had made it impossible, if not difficult, for Ukraine to export its wheat, corn, and sunflower oil to the wider world. He felt that they should help to get Russia to accomplish this task. The African states listen to the president, but it is uncertain that they are prepared to deviate from the Global South position that they should not join in the condemnation of Russia. However, President Zelensky was very happy that the summit decided to grant candidate status to Ukraine and its neighbor Moldova as the first major step for membership in the European Union. Finally, it must be understood that the candidate state in the European Union is only a first step that could take years to become full member, but the Ukrainians are very ecstatic that that decision had been made. When we turn to the summit meeting in Beijing, that is about the BRICS summit, as we discussed last week, the BRICS is an acronym for a group constituting Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa at the summit and other meetings almost throughout the week in China, ending on last Friday. The BRICS emphasized in the meeting that they believe in inclusivity and reject the idea of hegemony. They also stress that they want multilateralism in accordance with the Charter of the United Nations. And they are urging the group to work closely together to reform the WTO, the World Trade Organization, so that they could increase their influence. Because in the view, the world trade, 92% of the members of the WTO are involved with world trade. There are not much information globally to understand the BRICS group because it has only 16 years as it was formed in 2006. And it is vital to know because things are happening. They have deformed the new development bank, and this bank is functioning. The BRICS plan to widen and deepen the activities, and in this connection, they considered all the efforts by many states to join the group. And these states wanting to join are both in the Middle East, in Africa, and in Asia. And while they considered the principles and practice of admission to the group, the BRICS is already working on the plan, which is called the BRICS Plus, that they are prepared at this stage to allow other groups to join them in some aspect of the work. For example, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Egypt in the Arab world, Nigeria in Africa and Senegal, and in Asia, among others, Indonesia. So this is a very important group. And no matter what you have heard, the fact is that the group now constitutes 40% of the world population and almost 30% of the global GDP. They plan to continue the efforts, and it will be of interest that African states pay special attention to the development of that group because it may be relevant in the future for them. When we turn to the Commonwealth Summit in Rwanda, we have the situation where the first time the summit is being held in a former Francophone country, Rwanda. And this has been the practice recently where Francophone countries are seeking membership in the British Commonwealth, which was primarily former colonies of Great Britain. In this occasion, the summit admitted Togo and Gabon as new members in the 54-member group. What was also of importance in this group, that Prince Charles, who is substituting for his mother, ailing Queen Elizabeth, in this summit, addressed the members. In an earlier summit, the summit had agreed that should Prince Charles succeed to the throne in England or Britain, he would also become the head of the Commonwealth. He touched on two issues. First, he said that members of the Commonwealth should know that they are free to choose whether they want to remain members as a republic or to retain the head of the crown as the head. Then he went on to say something which was very, very important. Speaking personally, he expressed his sadness of the adverse effect of slavery and Britain's participation in it, and said he understands very much the adverse effects of slavery even to this day. This is a contrast to the difficulties that are being found in the United States, when some quarters do not want what they call critical race studies to be done even in university. So this is the situation, and a message that Africans should retain is that this group should be studied, if for no other reason that they are promoting multilateralism, and they are arguing that in the turbulent times we are going through, it is better to cooperate than to confront each other. Thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
To make planets, never would it reach a modern land. Mali,
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, even though chickens don't wash, their eggs are still white. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.